Welcome to What the Paper Said, in which I, Patrick Crozier, skim through the Times from 100 years ago, read some of the articles and comment on the ones I find interesting. In this episode, the week ending the 8th of July 1923, How to Get into America, The Dangers of Aluminium Cookware, The Met Office Gets What's Coming to It, A Death Sentence is Passed, Why Women Shouldn't Have the Vote, and How's That Occupation of the Ruhr Going? But first, the headlines. The Bank of England has raised its interest rate from 3% to 4%, which is a lot more than the present-day Bank of England would dare do. There's a dock strike going on. There's been a train crash up in Yorkshire, in a place called Diggle, which has killed four people. A substantial amount of space has been given over to what happened to the Trevessa. The Trevessa was a cargo ship. It sank in the middle of the Indian Ocean. Two lifeboats were launched. Both of now have made land. There are most survived, although those who drank seawater did not. There's a fair amount of correspondence going on about on the subject of Sunday games. Talking of games, Wimbledon is on. Good news for Frenchwoman Suzanne Lenglen, or Longlon, who's winning like crazy. Not such good news for Jean Barotra or René Lacoste, who've both gone out early. And there's been a bomb on a Belgian Ruhr leave train, or a Ruhr leave train for the Belgians. Estimated deaths range from 1 to 10. In other news, an MP has helpfully asked how the how much money is being extracted out of Germany in for reparations, and the government has replied, giving sort of sums for the first half of 1923 and equivalent sums for the first half of 1922. To cut a long story short, essentially, then the French and Belgians are doing no better than they were before, and especially if you include the costs of occupation, which has come up before. The question, by the way, was asked by one Captain Wedgwood Benn. Now, if you that name sounds familiar, well, yes, there was an Anthony Wedgwood Benn, who otherwise known as Tony Benn, who was, well, the most communist of the leading Labour Party figures in the late 70s and early 90s.
This Wedgwood Benn is his father.
Talking of which, the new government in Bulgaria has announced that it's found evidence of a communist plot. Now, as you've probably worked out, I am not someone who's particularly favourable towards communism and communists, but I think they're making it up. This week marks 7 years since the first day of the Somme, and a large number of notices have been made in the small ads to commemorate loved ones who died on that day. In the 13th of May episode, I mentioned the London to Brighton pram race, and the fact that this was a race in which mothers walked prams with young ones from London to Brighton, quite a distance. Anyway, a court case has been brought on the grounds of child abuse. Anyway, the case is concluded now, and they've been found not guilty. Although, to the best of my knowledge, no one will attempt this ever again. Some good news, also in the courts, some good news for Winston Churchill. He brought a libel case against the Evening News. The Evening News had claimed that he had massively overspent when, as colonial secretary, I think this must have been 1921, he visited Egypt. He has successfully claimed that he had a rather large entourage with him, and the case has been settled out of court. And Marshal Pilsudski of Poland has fought a duel. Well, he didn't die. Neither did the other guy who appeared. In fact, according to the Times, there's no bloodshed at all. I wonder if our Polish friends really understand the whole nature of a duel. Now, I'm going to have a new section, and it's going to be called Signs of the Times. These are not stories in themselves, but illustrate how the world has changed in the last century. The first one was something I noticed on Monday, the 2nd of July. I didn't read the article. It was simply entitled Agriculture in Sweden. Now, this is one of many articles on the subject of agriculture, although certainly in Sweden it's a bit of a rarity. The point being that agriculture is still a big deal, or certainly a big deal to the readers of the Times. So you would have thought with the Industrial Revolution that would have just swept this all away, but it hasn't. In much the same way, it also hasn't swept away religion, which also gets a fair amount of column inches. On Thursday, there was an advert for attire, not particularly interesting in itself. I can't even remember the name of the manufacturer, but I can remember the spelling. It was spelt with an I. Now, a lot of you out there will be thinking, well, shouldn't tire be spelt with an I? Well, yeah, probably should actually. But in England, for reasons I do not understand, we customarily spell it with a Y. Why we do this, I do not know. And clearly, there was a time when we didn't. So why did things change? Who knows? Not all changes for the better, let's put it like that. Another sign of the time came on Friday. It was a letter from the former leader of the Labour Party, J.R. Clines. I can't remember anything about the content of the letter. But the Times published his address, not just a road name, street name, but house number as well. I don't think even a Labour member of Parliament would do that nowadays. But then, well, they did, and presumably because they had no fear that anyone was going to come up and knock on their door and generally harass them. Which is, in a sense, weird when you consider the radicalism of the Labour Party at the time. I mean, they really believed they could nationalise everything. Everything would be fantastic. They even have a capital levy, a wealth tax, in essence. So there you go. On Tuesday, the 3rd of July, the Times published an article by a special correspondent on the subject of US immigration. He started by discussing the situation in the closing decades of the 19th century. By this time, the great prairie regions of the West were practically all settled up. The population was, as it still is, scanty as measured by European standards. But there remained no great tracts of practicable farming land still unoccupied. Instead, however, the newly developed manufacturing industries of the country were crying loudly for labour, and it was chiefly to meet this demand that the great tide set in from peoples of Eastern and Southeastern Europe, peoples among whom the percentage of illiteracy was high, and who had little conception of the meaning of liberty or democracy. This is not the first time I've come across this concept in the pages of the Times. Something very similar was said when they were talking about the conditions that led to Mussolini taking power in Italy. Anyway, it goes on. Concentrated in masses as they were, in industrial centres, instead of being spread out, like the earlier generations of immigrants, over the wide face of the country, these later comers presented a new and discouraging problem. For the first time, the country became uneasy as to its ability to digest the depressed and downtrodden masses of all nations. and that uneasiness was heightened by outbreaks of anarchist violence and the preaching of doctrines which, however excusable they may have been when looked at from a distance in despotic Russia, were clearly out of place in a republic. If memory serves me correctly, President McKinley was assassinated by an anarchist in 1900. He goes on. A novel factor, however, was now entering into the situation. A new terror was conjured up before the eyes of the American people by the war. As the conflict dragged on, and the extent of the ruin which it was causing became evident, they saw visions of an overwhelming flood of stricken peoples from all the war-devastated lands pouring into the United States. It was a real danger, and it was impossible to say how far the fundamental character of the United States and all its basic institutions might not be submerged under the torrent of war fugitives. The only safety seemed to lie in some positive numerical limitation of the total numbers to be admitted from all sources, and it was with comparatively little opposition that the present law was passed in 1921 and received President Harding's signature in May of that year. What they did was create a quota system and subdivide it by existing population. So if they said, well, 5% of our existing population is Italian, therefore 5% of the people who come in this year can be Italians. Anyway, the Times prints a table of quotas. I was amused to see that Britain got the highest quota, and Germany was in second. Britain, by the way, of course, at this stage, the United States is making no distinction between Britain and Ireland, and I'd be curious to know what the relative figures were there. I suspect that the Irish might in fact be the majority. Germany, by the way, was unable to fulfil its quota, which makes you think that maybe the devastation of war wasn't as great as you might think, or maybe they couldn't afford the fare. That's another possibility. Or it occurs to me, maybe they thought they wouldn't be particularly welcome. He goes on. The table, it will be noticed, contains no reference to either Canada or India. As for the former, the law does not apply to any part of the North or South American continent, or the adjacent islands, which include Bermuda and the West Indies. An alien from any part of the world can indeed qualify for admission to the United States by residing for 5 years in Canada, Newfoundland, Mexico, Cuba, or any other portion of the American zone. India, by the way, is on the banned list. You cannot be an Indian and emigrate to the United States. There has been an ongoing correspondence in the Times over the safety of aluminium cookware. This has prompted a letter from an H. Isles of the British Aluminium Hollowware Manufacturers Association. This is from Friday the 6th. It is surely as absurd to suggest that the growth of the mysterious diseases such as cancer is due to aluminium as it would be to suggest that they are due to the increased use of chocolate or tobacco or attendance at picture houses. Yeah, well, you have to feel sorry for Mr. Isles. It was a more innocent age, long before we became aware of the dangers of the Hollywood movie. The world abounds with dangers, especially if you're a weather forecaster. This is from Friday the 6th of July and comes from the In Brief section. Emily Ada Ellis Rue, 46, no occupation, of Star Street, Paddington, was remanded in custody. Is there any other form of remanded? By the Bow Street magistrate yesterday on the charge of committing willful damage by throwing a stone at a window of the meteorological office at Astral House, Kingsway. The defendant said that she broke the window at a protest against the wicked, willful waste of public money on the maintenance of the incompetent meteorological department of the government. So is Miss, I assume it's a Miss Rue, a brave fighter for freedom, hewn from that stuff that made our country great, or someone who's been inconvenienced by a few inaccurate weather forecasts? We may never know. But what if we all started throwing stones at those who willfully wasted public money? HS2. Gone. DEI. Gone. NHS. Gone. It would be quite good. And now for something altogether more serious. In the 27th of May episode, I mentioned the discovery of two bodies at the bottom of a mine. This has now got into court. This is from Thursday the 5th of July. At Derby Assizes yesterday, the trial was concluded of Albert Edward Burrows, 62, labourer, on the charge of murdering Hannah Calladine and her illegitimate son Albert Edward, aged 14 months, whose skeletons were found in an old pit shaft at Glossop. The prisoner had been committed on the charges of murdering Hannah Calladine, her two illegitimate children, and a little boy named Tommy Wood, but only the indictments concerning the woman and her son, of which the prisoner was the father, were proceeded with. Sir Henry Maddox, KC, was leading counsel for the Crown, and the prisoner was defended by Mr. T.N. Winning, with whom was Miss Cobb. I assume this Miss Cobb was a barrister, and if so, she must have been one of the very first female barristers. It goes on. The jury, after a short absence, returned a verdict of guilty. I think I've mentioned this before, that in those days, first of all, the gap between charge and trial was very, very short. I mean, nowadays it seems to be months, if not years. And also, the speed at which juries make decisions is also very quick. It goes on. Asked if he had anything to say, Burrows replied, "I am not afraid of death, but I am not guilty. I love those children and the woman too. As I hope to meet my God, I am innocent." Mr. Justice Shearman then passed sentence of death. On Monday, the Times published a letter from Henry Craik MP, in which he said this, "I have been a consistent opponent of women's suffrage, for one supreme reason, that it seemed to me certain to detract from the supreme position of woman." Well, pick the bones out of that one, and that, by the way, is all he has to say on the subject. Anyway, that's all for this week. I aim to have something up next week, but I promise nothing.